part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar Yoga with specialty classes for men's flexibility, women's health, seniors, and plus size. New classes start June 1st. Information available at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about water resources in the state of Illinois. Here in this part of the country, we tend often to take water for granted, unlike other places where it is more scarce. However, it is not a resource, not a bottomless resource, and more people in this region are thinking about the fact that we ought to be managing it much more carefully. We'll talk about some of these issues with Derek Winstanley. He is Division Chief of the Illinois State Water Survey. Then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about the Alexander Technique. Just in brief, people who do this believe that the way that we use our bodies, the way that we move, often can be the root of a lot of pain and illness. And by learning to move properly, you can be happier and healthier. We'll be talking with a couple of people who are going to be here to take part in a big conference in Champaign-Urbana on the Alexander Technique. Stephen Shaw, who uses the Alexander Technique and applies it to swimming, he's visiting here from London, and also Jane Heirich. She's an emeritus professor at University of Michigan who is interested in the Alexander Technique and voice. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about American politics. And I think if you listen to people who've been around Washington for a long time, they will tell you that politics here in this country are more polarized than they have ever been. However, our guest for this part of Focus 580, his name is Mark Satin, says that he thinks that most Americans are not as polarized as the media would suggest. He says that there are a growing number of people who are kind of alienated from the extremes of the political spectrum, who find themselves somewhere in the middle, who are interested in trying to adopt some of the best ideas of both the right and left and craft a new kind of position. And what some people have called this is the radical middle. He says that a growing number of people look at the world in a way that is both practical and idealistic, something that he calls idealism without illusion. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk with Mark Satin about his book, Radical Middle, The Politics We Need Now. It's published by the Westview Press. He is editor of the Radical Middle newsletter, which you can find on the internet, and has contributed articles to various publications, including Esquire, the Utney Reader, and also the annual Survey of American Law. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's talking with us by phone. Questions are welcome. All we ask of people who call is that they're just brief. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455, if you'd like to join us. Mr. Satin, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. This idea of the radical middle, I know it's not a – I'm not sure who's credited with coining the term. I know you didn't. It's been kind of circulating around here with people who write about American politics for some time. What is your sense of just how organized a kind of thing it is? What constitutes the radical middle? How formalized is it?
Well, it isn't formalized in the sense that there's an organization and a charter and the ten best proposals or that sort of thing. But I think you could call it a movement now, because there are many people who are not just writing books about the subject, but who are actually proposing public policies in the think tanks in Washington that you could say are along these lines. And then there are many activists who use our books and our writings as a sort of guide to what they should work for in their local communities and on the state level. So while it's not formal, it's definitely a presence. And if you listen to some of the pollsters, you can find evidence that large numbers, perhaps even a majority of Americans, hold some of the kinds of positions that you could characterize as radical middle. In health, in housing, in foreign policy. Sometimes the stats are 50, 60, 70%, depending on what the issue is. Mm-hmm. And I think more generally, I mean, I don't want to talk too long. Please interrupt if you wish. But I think generally there's a sense on the part of many, many Americans that another 6 months of Bush bashing Kerry and Kerry bashing Bush through their surrogates is going to be so repellent to what many, perhaps most of us, hope to hear, which is for Mr. Kerry and Mr. Bush to articulately defend and explain their positions and say where they'd like this country to be in another 20 to 50 years. Who's thinking about the American people as a whole? It doesn't seem like either of the parties is doing that right now. The Democrats have their interest groups, and the Republicans have their interest groups, and they treat their interest groups well. I wouldn't deny that. But the interests of the American people as a whole, that is for us to have a sustainable economy, for us to have a health care system that serves everyone and yet doesn't overburden us with its costs, a desire to have real corporate reform in this country so we can maintain the capitalist system, but without the terrible exploitation and abuses that we've seen over the last 5 years, that have been exposed over the last 5 years, I should say. The whole list of issues, energy, which everyone now has wonderful rhetoric about energy, but if you look at who's actually proposing plans and scenarios where we can have a gradual moving away from our dependence on oil, you won't find it at the top of either of the major parties, that's for sure.
Hmm. Well, do you think that for people who are strongly committed and strongly identify, or maybe people who run under the banner of one of the other parties, are so strongly committed to an ideology that it makes it difficult for them to approach problem solving in a pragmatic way that says, well, let's forget whether we call ourselves Republicans and Democrats and have to adhere to some sort of partisan philosophy, or have to make sure that certain people are made happy. Setting all that aside, there's no way to set all that aside and say, okay, here's a problem. What's the best way to solve it?
Well, there is a way to set it aside. I think the first way is to admit that, and I think this is true probably of every human being, not just Democrats and Republicans, nobody has a handle on the truth. Everyone's insights are partial and have to do with who they are and what their experiences have been in life. And I think just a little bit of modesty would help politicians and also the rest of us realize that we have a lot to learn from people whom we don't agree with. And I think if we would listen to what people on the left are saying and to what people on the right are saying and to what people who don't claim to be ideological are saying, you'll hear from each point of view some wisdom. And I think, you know, we're entering the 21st century now. We've never had an American political point of view. All of our points of view, be they socialist, liberal, and conservatism, come from other countries. I think it's high time that we, you know, using our typical hard-won American pragmatism, put everybody's best insights into the pot and try to think of what will work in this incredibly complex, exciting 21st century we're entering. And I think a lot of Americans, not just Americans who were baby boomers like me, but especially younger Americans, are just so tired of the old ideologies, the old fights, the old backbiting. I have to say that right now, a couple of blocks from where I'm sitting, a bunch of liberal groups are meeting in a big hotel and talking about how to defeat Bush. And I was at much of the session yesterday. And boy, what they had to say was about 95% negative. Bush is bad because of A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And, you know, maybe all of those reasons are correct. I don't want to comment on that right now. I'm making a different point, which is that if we don't have people who think of themselves as change agents, who can't speak articulately and passionately about what we need to do in this country, we're never going to change. If change agents spend three quarters or even half or even a third of their time just bashing the other fella, then first of all, they're probably not listening. And second of all, they're not going to excite Americans about what we have to do in the 21st century. We can't continue riding on our successes of the past. We have to come up with new ways of thinking about health, biotechnology, foreign policy, affirmative action, all the hot button issues. Even marriage probably has to change for the 21st century. And one of the things I love about the radical middle is that we all of us, whether we come, as I do, from an activist background or whether we come from policy, public policy backgrounds, we're all of us committed to coming up with new and innovative ideas that borrow from everyone's best ideas. And how can we move forward without that?
We have a caller here, and we'd certainly welcome other people into the conversation. Probably I should introduce again our guest, Mark Satin. He's author of the book Radical Middle, The Politics We Need Now, published by the Westview Press. He's also editor of the Radical Middle newsletter. You can find him on the web if you have internet and you're interested. Also, you can, of course, go down to the bookstore and look for the book, Radical Middle.
Thank you, David. That is true.
And, of course, if you're interested in participating in the conversation, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here listening in not too far away from here in Normal. Line number 4, we'll go there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I don't know if I would consider myself in the radical middle by what I've heard so far, but I do. I consider myself a pro-life Democrat, and I've heard the term used a few times recently. And I think that's one issue that really costs the Democrats a lot. I know not a lot of people, but personally I know some people that vote Republican for that one issue. And I've never understood why, as a Democrat, I believe in life, and I don't believe in war. I believe in pro-life all the way, if you see what I mean. And I was wondering if you could comment why, if you think that hurts the Democrats in any way, that one issue. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Satin, you want to talk about globally, I guess, you want to talk about the issue of abortion?
Well, the caller raised a number of issues, actually. As far as whether that's hurt the Democrats, of course, anyone who votes purely on the basis of one issue, it will hurt the party that doesn't support that issue. I admire the caller for mixing and matching issues according to his lights and not according to lights of either major political party. That is what the radical middle is getting at. We need to mix and match depending on values that we hold dear, and move away from the traditional party definitions of what's right and what's wrong. So I think that's great. As far as abortion goes, it's of course one of the most difficult issues for radical middle thinkers, as it is for all Americans. There really isn't a radical middle position on the issue, other than the fact that I think if you look at what most of us radical middle thinkers are saying, you can say that we hold four key values. Just briefly there, how can we give ourselves more choices in life? How can we give ourselves a fair start in life? How can we maximize our potential as human beings? And how can we be of genuine use to the developing world? And when you look at those values, I think choice is the first of them, and it's prime. But so I doubt, and I don't think I've ever found a person who's written a radical middle book or done a radical middle policy paper who would say that abortion is wrong under all circumstances. But I think we would certainly recognize the complexity of the issue and not create hard and fast rules. The point is to give people individual choice. But I also have to say personally, for people I've talked with who consider themselves radical middle, most of us would not would if we were male, not ask our women not to abort, though of course the final decision is up to them, but I don't think we would we would eagerly have a lover or spouse of ours abort without saying, we'll do whatever we can to not make that necessary.
That seems to point to one of the problems that we have in politics, and that there are a number of issues that seem to be make or break issues, where people are going to say, look, either you're one way or another. Either you got it, you say yes or no, you're for it or you're against it, whatever it is we're talking about, and then immediately we start to draw lines.
Right.
And I don't know, how is it really possible to create, to craft a kind of position, a kind of ground where people are going to maybe they'll say, okay, we agree on most things, and on these other things we agree to disagree. That seems to be really tough, particularly on the hottest hot button issues, and abortion is one of them, because there are some people for whom that's the most important thing, and depending on whether however they define themselves, whether they think abortion should be available, whether they think it should not, then that's the end of the conversation. Which it may be the end of the conversation once you get to that point.
I think much of this has to do with the process by which the dialogue is conducted, though. I mean, there's a way of saying, this is what I believe, and if you don't believe the same thing, you're wrong, you're sinful, you're insensitive, you're boorish, there's a whole list of epithets. You can go on and on. I think, though, that what you want to do is create a conversation where each party is aware of the difficulties of one's own position, and also as well as the difficulties and small hypocrisies involved in anyone else's position. I mean, it's one thing to say I'm right and you're wrong, and it's another thing to say I feel my position is the better one and I've thought hard about it, but it's an extraordinarily difficult issue, and if you disagree with me, you're still part of my world, my family, my country, my Karas, you're still one of me, one of us. And if we can simply improve the dialogue or debate so that it reaches that point, I think we'll have advanced tremendously.
Let me ask you just broadly to talk some more about radical middle kind of political philosophy. And I realize I'm going to ask you again a very broad question, but talking about geopolitics, now one of the most maybe controversial issues is what should be the American place on the world stage? How should the United States conduct itself? What should our foreign policy be? When should we involve our military in another country? And here now, of course, the current most difficult case study is Iraq. Whether we now have a great debate going on, and I'm sure as we move more into the presidential election season, there'll be even more debate upon whether that was the right thing to do and what we do now. What is the radical middle way of thinking about issues like that? How you think about the power of the United States, how it should be exercised?
Well, in general, I don't want to sound like the definitive one author. There are many of us: Ted Halstead, Matthew Miller, John Avlon, Tony Giddens, who all have somewhat different takes on it. But what I would say, and I think this would generally be shared by all, is that the United States has tremendous power in the world. Partly because we've been very successful as a nation, and we've learned many things that are useful, and I think we would want to share our power in such a way that we can help to empower other countries, even as we don't give up being the strongest nation on earth. I think in the long run, if we want to remain strong and secure, it's in our interest to help other nations become both democratic and prosperous. And so we should use our power in order to accomplish those two goals. Now, as far as what we did in Iraq, I am less against the war than most of the people I know, even in Washington. I think the idea of nudging a part of the Muslim world into the 20th century, I mean, we're already in the 21st, but nudging it into the 20th century might have been a good idea. but the way it was done from the get-go was all wrong. I mean, it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but how in the world can the intelligent people around Bush justify not having sat down with all of the factions in Iraq before the invasion and working out some plan for the transition period? You don't have to be really very smart or thoughtful or sensitive to do that. It just makes common sense. And similarly, how you can invade a nation of 25 million people, which is torn up into different factions and groups with animosities that in some instances stretch back hundreds and hundreds of years, how you can do that without fewer than 500,000 troops is beyond me. It's been beyond many of the people in the Pentagon and the State Department and the National War College, many of whom did studies before the invasion, pointing out that large numbers of troops needed to be on the ground. So I would fault our invasion of Iraq not for the idealistic purpose that it did on some level serve, but that the kinds of people carrying the invasion out were not qualified by temperament or by perhaps they were thinking of different things, such as access to oil. I don't know, but simply on a strategic level, the planning was dreadful, and the behind the scenes here in Washington, people at the Pentagon, at the State Department, people high up in the various bureaucracies that have any say over the situation are livid. Some of this is finally beginning to spill out into the Washington Post, but it's kind of interesting going to some of the think tanks here in town at the talks, because what you hear is just so many government workers and people who believe so strongly in this country venting their fury at their inability for their own good, sensitive suggestions to have been taken seriously by the powers at the very top here in Washington.
Mm. Well, now I've opened this door, and I'm hoping that I don't really think we need to get involved in a. If people want to talk about that, it's fine, but it's not really my intention to turn the program into a discussion about whether or not the war in Iraq was right. Let me ask you a slightly different question, and then we'll get to some phone calls. And that is, I think one of the concerns a lot of people do have is that when we made that decision to go to war, there was not a real free, open, thoughtful debate about whether or not that was the right thing to do. And people have faulted, and I think justly so, most news media in this country for failing to ask enough questions. When it comes to that or anything else that's as big a decision as that, how do we somehow get more people involved and have more of a conversation about what's the right thing to do?
That's a very good question. I'm actually going to a conference in about 2 weeks that's going to take up exactly this question, the Democracy in America seminar, which is bringing people together from all over the country to figure out what mechanisms we can put in place for Americans to become more involved in decisions like that. You mentioned the media, and there's a marvelous suggestion that's come from one of the radical middle thinkers, Matt Miller, which is for every newspaper to put at the very bottom of its first page simply a list of questions that Americans need to be thinking about at any one time. Often when we read the paper, we don't realize that issues are being proposed that are up for discussion, that are up for grabs. And the idea is that the media could, at the very bottom of the front page, or perhaps at the very bottom of the television screen, help point out to Americans what the flashpoints are, what the issues are that desperately need debating and need human input in. On the other hand, you know, David, it's very easy to blame the media, to blame darker forces for Americans not focusing on what we need to focus on. I would make another point too, which is that in many ways we've never had a more helpful media the Internet gives us access not just to websites of questionable veracity, but to websites of fabulous information and insight. Anyone now, I mean, I grew up in small towns in the Midwest where I had no access to a good newspaper. Not to sound arrogant, but it just was true that I never had good access to information about what was going on in the world until I went to university, which happened to be the University of Illinois, but that's a different story. But now anyone can flip on the Internet and go to the New York Times, the Washington Post, any number of wonderful magazines that are politically driven on the left. You can look at The Nation on the right. You can look at the Weekly Standard, and you can look at stories and articles that are thoughtful, that are fact driven, that raise issues that we need to mull over, and then we need to look at those. I mean, it may be more fun to read other matters simply to stare at the television, but we need to look at good informational sources, think about them, talk about them at work. And I spend a great deal of time toward the end of my book talking about what people can do at work. And the fact is that we have many, many, many wonderful groups now, probably more than we've ever had in American history, both at the local level and the national level, that are attempting to do good work in the cities or in the country as a whole. The groups exist. There's a sociologist named Robert Wuthnow at Princeton who's recently calculated that 4 out of 10 of us, an enormous number, 4 out of 10 of us belong to one of these sorts of groups. And whether they're more religious or spiritual in orientation or more explicitly political, they're all taking stands on social issues. And if we're not involved in one of them, then nothing's stopping us from becoming so. It doesn't take much time, and it's actually a lot of fun. So some of the burden really is on us. It's not just on the media to give it to us in pablum form. We can't have a democracy without engaged citizens, and this is not a police state. No one's keeping us from being engaged.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I have some callers we'll get right to. Our guest is Mark Satin. He is editor of Radical Middle Newsletter, and if you do have Internet access, you can find it at www.radicalmiddle.com. Also, you can look for his book, which has now been out a few months, called Radical Middle, The Politics We Need Now, published by Westview Press. We have several callers here. We'll start out with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I had the opportunity of reading your book a couple of weeks ago, and from the biographical information you kind of provided about yourself, you kind of come across as someone from the left who's moved to this position. I got a couple of questions. Do you know of people from the right who have moved to this position that the listeners would know of? And also, with regard to the Clinton era and triangulation, how does that relate to this at all, or does it really fit, or is it just a totally different sort of concept? And I'll hang up and await your answer. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, two really good questions. As far as people from the right moving to this position, probably the best known at this point is a person named John Avlon. He was a speechwriter for Rudy Giuliani for the last 4 years of the Giuliani administration. But he's come out with a book just recently about the same month that mine came out, called Independent Nation. And it's about as pure a radical middle take on the world as you can get. It's very interesting. There's also a generational difference between us, and I think that affects. I've met him a few times at this point, and that also affects the paths that we came to this point of view by. He, growing up under Reagan, found conservative ideas much more exciting and fresh and congenial. He's all of 31 now, I think, and I, growing up in the 60s, of course, found all the professors were conservatives, and the most interesting social thinkers in the mid-60s were, by no accident, liberals and radicals. But John's overwhelming concern is to create a politics that speaks for everyone, not just for the different factions. An independent nation is a very honest accounting of where conservatives as well as radicals have failed to do that, and because he has just as much a positive bent as I do. Most of the book is about people, not just the Teddy Roosevelts and the John F. Kennedys, but even to some extent the Pat Moynihans and the Nixons, more ideological types, who found at least at some points in their life that it made sense to think in terms of a whole, rather than in terms of what the Democratic or Republican factions wanted. So John is my best example of a conservative who's come this way, and his book is Independent Nation. As far as triangulation, boy, that whole thing gave what I call the radical middle a bad name. Dick Morris's triangulation was coming up with a straw man on the left, a straw man on the right, and then positioning or trying to talk Bill Clinton into positioning himself in such a way that he could appear to be this honest broker between two stupid points of view. In some ways, what I mean by radical middle, and Avalon means by radical middle too, is just the opposite of that. Instead of seeing the other people, instead of seeing the left and the right as wrong, you see the left and the right as essentially having part of the necessary truth, especially if you talk to people on the left and right and get beyond the ideological verbiage and into the deep concerns and needs and fears and desires those people have to see a better America. You often find principles and policies that you would avoid at your peril. So I don't triangulate in order to put the other side down. But I like to see the left and the right in perspective so I can take what's needed from them and then move into the current time, which is a very different time than we saw before globalization, the fall of the Soviet Union, and try to make myself relevant by that to that time by integrating left and right and also going beyond it. It's not just a synthesis. You need to do creative thinking about the different public policy areas in order to speak to the astonishing nation that we've all suddenly become.
All right, let's continue. We'll go to a caller in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Another question dating back to the Clinton era. I remember back in the 1990s, two terms, social liberals and fiscal conservatives were called the moderate middle, and then social conservatives and fiscal liberals were called the radical center. So I wondered, does your term, are you trying to conclude both of those, or is it something different?
No, it's somewhat different. The mixing and the matching is part of what I do. The social liberal, fiscal conservative, and vice versa are all interesting ways of moving beyond the traditional polarizations. In some ways, I suppose you could say that what my version of radical middle is a bit more social liberal and a bit more fiscally conservative than what the dominant strain is in American politics now. But I wouldn't say that's what's at the core of it. What's at the core of it is the four key values that I gave earlier in coming up with public policies that give us more choices, but that don't leave equity in the dust in the meantime, and that look to our potential as human beings. That we need public policies that aren't just about getting more things. We need public policies that will make us more thoughtful and more caring human beings, both at home and abroad. And to the extent that social liberalism and fiscal conservatism serve those values, I would endorse them, but it isn't always true. I mean, one of the neat things about radical middle as I see it is it takes you off of trying to make everything incredibly neat and opens up a way for a more feelingful way into public policy, where if you meet these values, which all of them serve life, of course, then you can mix and match your policies to serve the values and the human needs of people. So even though I'm probably sympathetic to social liberalism and fiscal conservatism in general, I wouldn't use those as templates or as models of every public policy I'm going to come up with.
Well, I think the radical center was a fairly good label for what were also in the 1980s were called the Reagan Democrats.
Yes.
And I think what the Bush administration has been doing is a lot of the same thing that Reagan did, which was basically using social conservatism as a bludgeon, to terrify people into going along with the Republican Party, and at the same time, sabotaging the nation's finances by building up these budget deficits and national debts and trade deficits, going against the interests of these blue collar workers who voted for them, at the same time that they're instilling this fear, that they would have to vote for them. So anyway, I'll get off and listen, but I just wanted to make that comment.
All right, thanks very much for the call. We'll go on here to someone else. Next caller is in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to return to an earlier comment you made. I think your description of the invasion of Iraq, as you described, as an attempt at nudging the Middle East into the 21st century, that this description is incredibly ill-conceived. We cannot forget the context that we have through a decade of sanctions kept Iraq from vital 21st century technologies necessary for such necessary civil services as water filtration. And as a result, some 500,000 people have died, to which our own Secretary of State responded that the price was worth it. And now our nudging of Iraq into the 21st century, as you say, is less likely to be successful at implementing a democracy as it will be successful in privatizing their valuable resources and gaining another strategic military position. So to call yourself a radical middle is, I think, disingenuous. I think you're quite in line with ideologues that motivate and inform dominant U.S. powers and policies. So I think the other thing it does is it marginalizes the rest of a spectrum that that you're implying is balancing on either side of your middle position, which I can't quite see there.
Well, Mr. Satin, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, those are fair criticisms. I simply disagree with them. I think that if you have a billion people in the world who are being educated to in hatred and who aren't being exposed to scientific texts, and if you have a billion people where women's rights are not only taken seriously but not recognized, you have a problem. You have a billion people where hatred and prejudice will fester and grow, and because technology has now made it possible for everyone to see how everyone else lives, you will then get a billion people who are not only developing themselves economically, but who'll see that other nations are developing themselves economically, and they'll come to the not surprising conclusion that other nations are working and their nations aren't working because they're being done to somehow. You just can't. I mean, to me, this is so obvious that it's just the starting point for you have to figure out how do you relate to the Muslim world. Well, obviously, you don't want to do things that are arrogant. So, no, I don't support the way the invasion was done. I'm sorry if I created the impression that I supported Bush's invasion of Iraq. I thought I said that I'd do it completely differently, beginning with sitting down with all the factions in Iraq and also beginning with getting a commitment from the United States and hopefully more of the world than Bush was able to get, that they would, among them, put 500,000 troops on the ground so the country wouldn't descend into chaos once the fighting was over. I do think that the invasion could have been carried out with the will of the majority of the Iraqi people behind us. In fact, if you believe polls, it was there when we invaded, even under the dreadful conditions of the invasion that we imposed on the Iraqi people. So I think it could have been done without offending the great majority of the Iraqis, and in fact, with their support. But it wasn't done in that way, and it's one of the great tragedies of our century so far that hasn't been done. But to say that we could just ignore what's going on in the Arab world now, the lack of schooling, the terrible situation of women, the fact that the countries barely have an infrastructure, many of them, the unbelievable factional fighting and tribal warfare, to say that we can just ignore that and call it peace, I mean, this is one of the reasons that drove me away from the peace movement. I mean, they felt it was peace when, we're not doing what we should in Africa to prevent the wars in Africa, for example. Literally millions of people have been killed in the Sudan, in the Congo, in places that we're not following at all closely. Nobody pays attention to that. And for America to move in there would not be a breaking up of peace, so far as I'm concerned. For us to actually train, hopefully in conjunction with the United Nations, hundreds of thousands of peacekeepers, Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution is speaking of 200,000 peacekeepers that should be trained all over the world to be able to move into situations like that. To do this on a worldwide basis, for America to do its fair share there, to me is part of what I consider the peace movement in the 21st century. We simply cannot allow countries to break up into this horrible sort of civil wars and cross-border fighting. We have the means to prevent it. We have the knowledge to prevent it. We have the people power to prevent it. And most of all, having seen the 20th century, the unbelievable bloodiness of it, I think we should feel the moral obligation to stop as much of this horrible killing as we can, particularly since the victims of this sort of low-level warfare is to a vast majority. I think in most cases, over 90%, the victims are civilians and not the people who pick up the gun.
We have less than 10 minutes left. I have a number of other callers, so we'll try to get in some more folks. Our guest is Mark Satin. His book is Radical Middle, The Politics We Need Now, and it's published by Westview.
I have to say, David, my answers aren't usually this long, and I do think part of it is just that I'm so excited to be talking to people in the Champaign-Urbana area. You know, I went to school there in 64, 65 for less than 1 year. I dropped out to join the civil rights movement. But while I was there, I really enjoyed it, and I miss it, and I've never been back.
Well, I'm sure we'd welcome you back if sometime you wanted to stop by for a visit.
Thank you. I will do that.
Also, his website is radicalmiddle.com. He is one of a number of people who use this kind of terminology and position themselves this way. So if you're interested, you could certainly look for his book. But there are also others. In fact, if you go to his website, it will point you to a lot of other books and a lot of other websites if you're interested in exploring what various people think. And we also have a number of callers here, and we'll try to get at least a couple in before we find ourselves out of time. Urbana next, line one. Hello.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to trumpet another take on this whole topic, which you mentioned, actually. Ted Halstead and Michael Lind's New America Foundation and the newamerica.net website, which is full of articles about this kind of idea, and they're very good about coming up with specific solutions to some of our biggest problems, which eludes both the major parties. But I had a question about something that you had kind of touched on when you were talking about our relationship with or our interaction with the Muslim world.
Sure. I just want to say before you go on to the next to, to this next piece, that Halstead and Lind are terrific. I love their work. It's probably my most cited people in my book are them. They put on seminars that are now being attended by many people in the Washington public policy community, as well as people in nonprofits here, and they're having a tremendous influence. And Halstead blurbed my book. I was very proud for that to happen. And their earlier book, The Radical Center, was the first American book along these lines. So as a good activist, I always try hard to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, and their website has articles going back to 1999.
So does mine. We actually started at the same time, and I took care, just as they did, to spend three-quarters of my book on specific public policies, because that's really how you convince people, not through the more general sort of talk.
Well, I'd like to, if there were more time, I'd explore just how you do differentiate yourself. But the more important question to me is, I'm just curious, have you got any insights or any news to give us as far as one of the bigger problems we've got going here in the States, and that is that, as Ted Halstead refers to the Republicans as the party of the church, and how the Republicans take this very highly moralistic tone, and that despite the questionable morality of their actions, I'm just curious, have you heard anything, have any insights into how this supposed radicalism is going to digest that hard nut of a problem, the idea of a religion, fundamentalism, too, getting into our politics? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Satin, go ahead.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's, as I said at the beginning of this, I think every point of view, political point of view, has a grain of truth in it. And I certainly don't want America to become anything like a religious state, and no one in the radical middle does either. But what the radical right is saying that I think is true is that we need values in this country. We definitely need certain fundamental beliefs that can be translated into values that we hold dear, that we as an American people basically agree on and are willing to say, this is where we stand. And I've offered my four: give us choices, give us a fair start, maximize our potential as human beings, be of genuine use to the developing world. Halstead, who the caller mentioned earlier, is somewhat similar. He has choices. He doesn't have potential as human beings, since I'm more spiritual than he. He doesn't say genuine use to the developing world. But I would not disagree with his value. He says, how can we help the middle class in the developing world? And it amounts to the same thing in the end, doesn't it? I mean, if you don't have a middle class thriving, you don't have economic growth, and you don't have an increasing standard of living, and you have social misery, and you have a desire to strike back, and that will hurt us in the long run, even though in the short run, helping the middle class and being of use to the developing world more generally will cost us some money. In the long run, we'll save far more lives and far, far more treasure if we do the right thing and be helpful. So I think we can answer the conservative need for religion by talking about values and teaching those values in school. I mean, it would not be beyond the radical middle to want to see a value such as, how can we give ourselves a fair start in life, debated in school, understood in school, specific examples gone over in school. For example, is racial affirmative action giving everyone a fair start in life? Would economic affirmative action be a better way in to giving people a fair start in life? These values, as religious values tended to do, 1,000 years ago, these more secular values can lead to marvelous discussions that open people's hearts and minds.
Can you talk for, and we're just about out of time, so I can give you a minute, and I really mean a minute, about the role of government in our everyday lives here, set aside foreign policy. What should it be?
I really think that we are in a complex, large society like this one. Government needs, and I mean by government, I mean the national government, needs to take a leading role in debating and solving key social issues. Health care, for example, has to be solved at a national level. Education, fortunately, unfortunately, you need national solutions to education. You may need to federalize funding of education, for example, simply to ensure that people in some parts of the country aren't given wildly inferior educations to people in other parts of the country, and to make sure that people are learning the same sorts of things in different parts of the country. We can't have brilliant readers in state X and people who don't read very well, people who don't read real well in state Y. We just can't do that anymore at this moment in our history. We need to move beyond oil dependency. Only the federal government can channel funds intelligently into a program that would bring us beyond oil dependency. But there are ways of carrying out all these programs that don't overly empower the federal government. And I think it's very important to constantly watch and make sure that as the federal government becomes more streamlined and competent, we don't give it more authority.
We'll have to stop. I want to thank you, Mark, very much for talking with us.
Oh, we just scratched the surface, but it was a lot of fun.
Our guest, Mark Satin, if you'd like to read his book, it's The Radical Middle, The Politics We Need Now. Also, you can look at his website, which is radicalmiddle.com. Our program made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programs also made possible by Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-designed gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today, following the 1 o'clock news from National Public Radio, we'll talk with forensic anthropologist Clea Koff. She's the author of The Bone Woman, a forensic anthropologist's search for truth in the mass graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices on the Board of Trade are lower. July wheat, 370, that down 5. September wheat, 379, down 5 and a quarter. July corn, 311 and a half, down 10 and a quarter. September, 310 and a quarter, down 9 and a half. December corn, 310, that down.